From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, a 20-year retrospective on the floods of 1993.
They all were working on the assumption like we were sitting on our front porch fishing in the river. It's 2 miles from the river to the edge of town where the dike is. It filled that entire area up with water and then came over the dike.
A new book tells the story of some extraordinary black Missourians, plus a summer camp that's all about being secular.
It's a place where everyone becomes better questioners and better thinkers together.
And hear the first in our series about Kansas City's creative couples.
Our art world, whatever it is nearly fully integrated into our domestic life, our husband and wife are.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
20 years ago this summer, monsoon-like rains combined with unseasonably heavy snowfall and odd air pressure systems to cause massive flooding across 9 Midwestern states. 47 people died. The deluge forced tens of thousands of people from their homes, inundated 75 towns, and destroyed millions of acres of farmland. It caused an estimated $20 billion in damages. Laura Ziegler went back recently to visit some of the people and places affected by the floods and talk about some of the changes brought on by the catastrophic weather.
The words mass gravesite seem like something you'd expect to hear in a conversation about Bosnia or Cambodia, not about a cemetery in a tiny Missouri River hamlet like Hardin. But when a break in a levee some 15 miles away sent the swollen Missouri River rushing over the graveyard here, it separated caskets from soil and made a mess of the graves. Coffins were found floating throughout the floodplain for weeks. Some had been buried here for almost 200 years, and their remains were decomposed and too hard to identify.
Buried all the unknowns in a mass gravesite here.
How many are there?
800 plus.
Stephen Shirley is the caretaker of the Hardin Cemetery. He says there were so many exhumed coffins, they had to line them up at the county fairgrounds while the coroner and volunteer funeral workers tried to identify them. There's now a small lake the rushing floodwater gouged out in the middle of the graveyard.
Beautiful spot.
Well, thank you.
On one side, the original tombstones still stand in random order on the grassy lot. By contrast, on the other side of the lake, stones are set in symmetrical rows in concrete slabs, one behind the other. These were the tombstones the flood washed away.
Those are stones that we recovered from the lake. You can kind of see, for example, over there, the matter stone was stained by the water a little bit. We just recovered them and reset them and cleaned them up a little bit.
Volunteers and cash donations came in from as far away as Germany, and when the graveyard was restored, officials erected a marble memorial with the names of the bodies that were never recovered etched in the stone.
We had the lake pumped down, and then we got so low that the water was coming in faster than 4 pumps could handle it, so we never did get to the bottom of the lake.
How many bodies did you find?
There probably is 50 or 60 bodies that are not accounted for.
And Terry Johnson's grandparents were among them. She regularly visits the cemetery to remember her grandmother, even if it's just to visit a mass grave.
And Grandma used to always say, "Now, I want you to keep flowers on my grave." And so at least I got the stone where I can go down there and decorate her grave.
The town of Pattonsburg, Missouri, up I-35 through the Missouri River Basin, suffered losses of a different kind. It was one of a number of entire cities the Federal Emergency Management Agency bought out, encouraging residents to relocate to higher ground. Pattonsburg is surrounded on all sides by tributaries and creeks, and when the Missouri River crested at record levels in July of 93, the area filled up like a bathtub, says former school superintendent Gene Walker.
One of the people in Chicago said, "Well, I just don't know why you folks are next to the river." Well, they all were working on the assumption like we were sitting on our front porch fishing in the river. It's 2 miles from the river to the edge of town where the dike is. It filled that entire area up with water and then came over the dike.
FEMA came in, appraised each property, and offered the town $12 million. Businesses and public buildings weren't included. Not everyone was happy.
You put that many people in a room and throw a rock in, some people will like the rock and some people won't. We had folks who, left with a smile and thought they did real well, and you had somebody else that's, no, I didn't get enough.
After a series of long community meetings and consultations with architects and engineers, most took the money and the option to move. Once the town was torn down, the local government rented the acreage to farmers. Director Ang Lee doctored the demolished street front to use for his movie Ride with the Devil. Gene Walker cruises his SUV along naked roads through soybean fields and stops at a crossroads. There's a street sign bent 45 degrees to the ground next to a rusty fire hydrant.
Oh, of course, this is what ZZ, no, this is not ZZ, what's it say, West First Street?
West First Street.
First Street would have run this way, and then Main Street was from here down.
Nodding his head down a gravelly road toward what's now an expanded farm cooperative, Walker says the city center once had a watch repair, a bank, and a bowling alley. Across the railroad tracks, there were welders, the offices of The Call, the city's newspaper, and standing on that corner over there, a Western auto store.
And on this corner was Graham's Hardware that did a lot of the sewer and water work and plumbing and all that stuff around for people.
A few of those businesses have moved up here to New Pattonsburg, as residents call it. The commercial center is a block called Main Street, appropriately. It's separated by a grassy median and the only trees in the area. The shops are within a stone's throw of the houses and lawns. There's a distinctive movie set feel here, as if the whole place was lifted up and dropped on some farm fields, kind of like Dorothy's house landed in Oz. Residents tootle around in small vehicles, seeming to pull up out of nowhere.
Casey's one of our older residents. He drives his golf cart around rather than get his car out. Thinks it's a lot simpler. So.
Parking's a premium as people come and go from Main Street. There's a chiropractor, a consignment shop, and a photographer. The Old Memories Cafe and Pinky's Sub Shop do a brisk business at lunchtime. But if the town seems surreal, to drive around is to see how reality-based officials tried to be. The new school is a series of space-aged domes that are energy-efficient and sustainable. There's a retirement community and low-income housing. The back streets are a patchwork of newly built homes and those that were lifted off their foundations and moved up here.
And this one right here is ours.
Gene Walker's 19th-century Victorian was one of them.
1876.
Was that hard to move?
Not really, because it was all built at once. See, and they moved all of it. The leaded glass there, and then there's actually stained glass windows right here. Yep.
Our tour of Pattonsburg ends back down at the river bottoms, where Lyle and Donna Warford stayed put after the 93 floods. And today they're about the only family still living in the old town.
Hello, Laura. I'm Donna Warford. Come on.
It's a sprawling ranch home with a sign over the door that reads, Welcome Home. A massive arched oak tree shades the whole house.
Beautiful home.
You're stepping into what was once 3.5 to 4 feet of flood water.
Friends wouldn't let the Warfords go home for a day or so after the floods. When they did, they found mud and silt in the sink, stinky, putrid water covering her antique furniture.
In fact, we had a Siamese cat and a 40-pound pig on the table that had floated in and then didn't know where to go.
Donna's mother's hand-sewn quilts were soaked, and many of their antique clocks were swept away. It moves Lyle and Donna to this day to recall the help they got from friends, family, strangers, even prisoners from the Cameron Corrections Facility.
There's always somebody worse off than you are.
Probably the best part is the help we had.
There is never any way we can ever repay the people that helped us. We had tremendous response from people away from here, people we didn't know.
Lyle's dad was the Pattonsburg mayor in the 40s. The Warford son is the mayor today. Donna says it would be very hard for them to move away.
Roots get planted pretty deep, and I'm not saying we ever, ever want to experience another flood, but this is home.
The Warfords got the same disaster relief as everyone else in Pattonsburg, $10,000, and an offer on their home if they wanted to relocate. Lyle estimates it would have cost 20 times what they were offered, so he turned down the deal. And because he's not in the residential area of town, he's never been eligible for flood insurance. They know they've made a tough choice.
And you know what? If it's not raining, we don't think about it.
Army Corps of Engineers flood management specialist Judd Knieve says it's fine to stay in the floodplain as long as those who do remember one thing.
You never eliminate the risk.
Strolling along the gravel bike path atop the well-manicured L385 levee in Riverside, Knieve points out the new technology like gates and drainage pipes designed to control seepage and overflow. This was a small agricultural levee in 1993, like many that were involved in the floods. Since then, the Corps and local governments have started to collaborate more in an effort to maintain the quality of the levee system. Knieve says the Corps' primary focus is to communicate a new message.
The biggest change fundamentally in the last 20 years for the Corps of Engineers is that we're putting a lot of emphasis on communicating that when you live and work in a floodplain, you're always at risk. It doesn't matter what type of flood risk management project that's been constructed to help you.
In 1993 and again during floods in 2011, critics claimed the Corps made bad decisions in efforts to mitigate the impact of flooding. They say politics, as always, played too great a role. But as development creeps back into the floodplain, even top experts agree the focus must be on the message. If you live near the river, you're never immune to the impact of floods. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
An alternative summer camp for kids whose families aren't religious. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Every summer you can find camps around the area for young people interested in everything, from pottery to ecology to modeling. And this year there's a new option, a secular summer camp with a focus on science and critical thinking. Alex Smith braved heat and bug bites to bring us this report.
On the first morning of camp, a handful of young teenagers psych themselves up to take on a high ropes course 30 feet off the ground.
I want to do that because I'm a daredevil, but I'm protected.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's a little bit.
One by one, the campers climb up to reach the ropes. Some race across the obstacles while others freeze up, scared by the heights.
I am class A, terrified for my life.
Some conquer the course in 15 minutes, others take an hour. But in the end, they all scream with exhilaration as they race down the long zip line at the end. In early July, 20 campers came out for 5 days and four nights to the first ever Camp Quest Kansas City. They canoed in a lake, swam in the pool, went fishing, basically doing everything kids do at camps everywhere. But Camp Quest Kansas City isn't a YMCA or scout camp. It's designed for kids from atheist, agnostic, or free thought backgrounds. Parent and volunteer David Spake says that too often, even non-religious camps make assumptions about religion by leading prayers or non-denominational worship services.
So you think, well, that's no big deal, but it is for some people.
Spake says he was excited that Camp Quest could provide an alternative experience for his daughter Avery.
Being just a child in school and having parents who are atheists or humanists, and the children tend to grow up more critically asking questions about a religion, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of kids who feel threatened by that. And as a result, like my daughter, she's been ostracized a bit at school where we live at because she's asking hard questions.
Camp Quest is a national organization that's helped organize secular camps around the country since 1996. But this is the first year for a camp in Kansas City. It's for kids ages 8 to 17. Like all Camp Quests, the Kansas City version focuses on science and problem solving, and it offers campers a chance to think about big issues and ask tough questions in a daily discussion called the Socrates Cafe.
So the first day we did What is Knowledge, and then we had Frank, our special guest.
It's early in the afternoon, and the 20 campers sit in a big circle along with counselors in the air-conditioned Main Lodge building. Pool time is next, so the kids are wearing swimsuits under their T-shirts. One camper wears a goatee made out of black electrical tape. Camp Quest's National Executive Director, Amanda Metzges, runs a poll to decide on the day's discussion topic.
What is life? What is nature? What is the mind?
Typical topics include separation of church and state, or what is knowledge. Today's nominations include aliens and time travel. After the young campers vote, Metzges announces the winning topic.
All right, I think pretty clearly we have 9 votes for death. It's a weird sentence. And pretty low votes for everything else. So I think that our topic today is going to be what is death.
So for the next hour, the campers talk unflinchingly about the meaning and significance of death.
The thought of living forever is more scary than dying to me, because living forever is when you see all of your friends die, and then your next friends, and then your next friends. It will never end. You'll always wonder what's next.
It's an intense discussion. Several campers cry talking about the death of pets or grandparents. One young camper says it's hard for him to understand why life is like this. But once the hour's over, the kids get up, wipe away the tears, and head out for the pool. While the campers do cannonballs, Amanda Metzges stays behind to talk a little about Camp Quest. As the executive director of the national organization, Metzges spends a lot of time at summer camp. She says activities like the Socrates Cafe are designed to teach thinking skills.
It's not the case that the adults know the answers and that they're trying to get the kids to come up with some answer that the adults already have in mind. It's a place where everyone becomes better questioners and better thinkers together.
Metzges studied political science and psychology in college, and she's co-written a book about free-thinking parenting. But she says she learned camp counseling on the job during her 10 years with Camp Quest. According to Metzges, death is not one of the more common Socrates Cafe topics, but it does come up from time to time. And part of Camp Quest is creating a safe space for this kind of discussion.
No one wants to talk to kids about this in a serious way, because it's scary. You know, it's scary for adults to talk about it because, you know, we lose our cool a little bit. And it's also, there's a sense that, you know, nobody wants to kind of bring up a topic that's difficult. But not talking about it is worse. You know, then kids are left sort of dealing with these issues by themselves and getting the sense that it's not okay to ask questions, or it's not okay to say anything about the stuff that's going on in their lives.
Out by the pool, camper Amelia ranks the philosophical discussions among her favorite camp activities.
Well, I think they're a really nice time to see and hear what other people think when you don't normally get to see or hear them a lot. Because, like, they're boys and, you know, girls and boys are separated in the cabins and stuff, and so you get to hear their opinions more. So it's really fun to hear what they have to say.
Camp Quest has occasionally drawn controversy. Back in April, Joe Davidson, the founder of Oklahoma Joe's barbecue chain, stopped a Camp Quest fundraiser while it was taking place at his Tulsa restaurant. He says he hadn't been informed that the fundraiser was for a secular camp. Camp Quest Oklahoma says it had been clear with the restaurant about its mission statement. Amanda Metzges says that more frequently, Camp Quest has problems finding places to host camp. Local groups typically rent space at campgrounds, but they're sometimes denied permission when they tell campground owners what the camp is all about. Local president Lindsay Burns says she had trouble finding a welcoming campsite in Kansas City.
I did have one person who, he asked me if I was an atheist, and when I told him that I was an atheist, he actually told me that he wouldn't have any animals sacrificing in his land and hung up on me.
Ultimately, Camp Quest found a home at Wildwood Education Center, about an hour south of Kansas City. Each day at Camp Quest ends around the campfire. The fire pit overlooks a small lake which shimmers with an orange light in the setting sun. As the temperature drops a few degrees, volunteer Sarah Hargreaves leads the campers through camp songs. After the sun sets and the singing ends, parent David Spake tells the story of the emperor's new clothes to the curious campers.
And he's completely naked.
Like no underwear?
No underwear, no nothing.
Oh, my God! Put the pants on him!
Spake now hopes that campers like his daughter will leave Camp Quest with the feeling that they're not the only ones asking tough questions about the world around them.
Having a camp where she can come and ask those questions and know that she's not going to get ostracized, that everybody else is asking those questions and more, really gives her a chance to expand, to grow, to feel comfortable with who she is.
Campers Jacob and Anna Sophia say Camp Quest has introduced them to like-minded kids.
Just meeting people that are so similar but look like everybody else out in the world. I mean, they at least are willing to open up themselves once you get to know them, and then they're willing to help you out.
The biggest surprise is probably how open a lot of the people here are. You know, you wouldn't think you'd get so close to people you've only known for a few days, but I knew I would come and make some friends, but I didn't think that, like, everybody here would become my friend, or at least it feels like it.
Local Camp Quest organizers say they're already making plans for summer 2014. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
She comes on like a rose, but everybody knows she'll get you in touch. Not touch. Poison ivy, poison ivy. Late at night while you're sleeping, poison ivy comes a-creeping around. She's pretty as a daisy.
Written histories of Missouri often overlook the contributions of African Americans, but a new book, Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who've Made History, attempts to fill in the gaps. The book includes stories about well-known Missourians like Tina Turner, Dred Scott, and Langston Hughes. But St. Louis-based authors John and Sylvia Wright say that the untold stories of unsung African Americans are the most compelling. Susan spoke to them recently from a studio at St. Louis Public Radio to hear more about the book.
John Wright and Sylvia Wright, it's a pleasure having you here on Casey Currents.
Thank you so much.
So, first of all, and I guess this question is to both of you, what motivates your interest in Black history?
Well, it goes all the way back to high school when I was in the Negro History Club in high school. So it's been a long time interest because many things I've learned have been left out of our history books. And so if you want to become well-rounded, especially if you're in education and working with youngsters, where you can add things that they won't get unless you bring it to the attention of those who are teaching them.
Was there anything in particular that you learned about Missouri that helped produce so many extraordinary people who were African American?
No, I think St. Louis, by being the gateway, many people came through St. Louis before heading west. And so in the early part of the history of the country, African Americans coming through St. Louis played a major role in that history. Also, the civil rights movement in St. Louis, there were some landmark cases that came out of St. Louis that had profound impact on the nation. And so learning that in history and studying history, it just made you want to do more and make sure everyone's aware of that.
Now, I noticed in your book, there are names that many of us know very well. I mean, you have Langston Hughes and Maya Angelou and, Arthur Ashe, Josephine Baker. But then you also have included some lesser-known people. Why was it also important to include maybe those unsung heroes, those names of people that others may not be aware of?
Well, in doing the book, we found after we finished, we have a whole large number of other individuals who are unknown. And it's good to give credence to those who we all know. We don't want them to be forgotten. But also there are a group of individuals who little has been told about their trials and tribulations and the things they did to overcome many obstacles, and those stories need to be told also. So it's trying to do a combination of living, deceased, current, past, heroes, and individuals who've contributed to this nation.
So listen, let's talk about someone that probably very few people know about, and that's York, who played a role in the Lewis and Clark expedition. John, do you want to talk a little about York?
Yeah, the interesting thing, most of the books leave York out, but I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to put more about York in the small passage we have, because you're limited to about 350 words. But York was what do you call a shadow leader. You know, he would go out, scout the trails, he would make friends with the Indians, he was able to carry a rifle. And most slaves who weren't too bright, the team would never let them lead them through the wilderness. They were always dependent upon York, because in the Indian culture, black was magic. And I understand from some of the writing, some of the men even were jealous of York because some of the Indians wanted their wives to be with York. And, you know, that caused tension sometimes.
Now, there's a story in your book about a 14-year-old slave named Celia. Really a demonstration of the kind of injustice that was done during slavery. Do you want to talk some about that?
Yes, she had been purchased at the age of 14. And the gentleman who purchased, I don't know if I can call him a gentleman, but the individual who purchased her, before they got home, he began to have sex with her. Out of that relationship, forced relationship, there were a couple of children born. One of the individuals who was enslaved on the same farm had a strong affection for Celia and told her if the gentleman who was the individual who was having an affair with her, if he kept staying around, he would no longer continue to see her. She was ill. She had told Mr. Newsom, who had kept coming to the cabin, not to come. And he forced himself on her, and she hit him with a log and kept hitting him and then burned the body up. They searched for him the next morning. So finally she confessed of the killing. Whites even hit her while they appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court for her to be released because of the situation. She was hung. They waited till the baby was born. He was born, stillborn, and they hung her. And her relatives are still live in St. Louis, and they've tried to make contact with the Newsom family, and they've been in that area. And so it's a story that's well known pretty much in the area here now, because family members, there is a book written about this whole incident, a number of textbooks. She's listed as one of the stories of slavery.
Now, as you think about all of these stories, are there any others that really stand out to you or were especially interesting to you as you did the research?
In doing the book and reading about Jim Beckworth, who was, he was a pioneer, sort of. He was a scout for those going west. And the thing that impressed me mostly about him, he became part of an Indian tribe as well, but the fact that there is a pass through the Sierra Mountains that's named for him because he was the one that found it and guided people on their way to California and, you know, further westward. And I just think that's just a wonderful thing to be a part of our map, the map of the United States, with a name, Jim Beckworth. Or it's Beckworth Pass.
Beckworth Pass, yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Beckworth Pass.
Alvin Coffey is an interesting story. He left St. Louis with the 49ers going west, and he was told by his owner that you can make enough money and you can buy your freedom. And his owner was sick most of the time, so Alvin worked like a dog. And the owner decided it was time to come back. And so when he returned to St. Louis, they sold him and kept the money. All the money he had made for himself and his owner was all kept, and he was sold. His new owner allowed him to go back to California. And when he returned, he had enough money to pay for his family's freedom and his freedom. And he became the only African-American of the California pioneers. And his family did well in the valley. He opened the first school for African Americans and Indians out there in the valley. And I think that's a story that tells of determination. In spite of all the obstacles, he could have given up. But he said, let me go back. I'll make enough money to pay you for my family and my freedom and make it worth your while to let me go back to the gold mines. And so he worked day and night, mining gold, doing laundry, and saved enough money to purchase his freedom and his family's freedom.
Now that's really some determination, isn't it?
That is.
So what statement do you hope your book makes about African Americans in Missouri?
Well, I think it's anything's possible if you have a vision and a dream and determination. I think that's the key. And it also says what African Americans have done to help shape the history of this country. Because important court cases help make America what America's supposed to be and should be for everyone.
Is it also part of your mission to show young people that the people who had success, the people that did succeed, also had to learn how to fail and how to stumble?
Yes, we have, you know, the story of Sonny Liston. You know, he was a success, but he died over drug overdose. You know, he didn't know how to cope with his success. And Red Fox, although we don't talk about it, he got so angry, he had a heart attack on the set and ended his career. It's learning how to cope. You know, we talk about their failures. Everyone wasn't a shining example in every phase of their life, but they had determination and a dream to reach that determination. I think that's the most important thing.
Susan, and John is right. But the other thing about the book and learning about these people who came through many trials, many of them did, is that it's important that students know, but everybody knows in this country, that we've all had we've all contributed to this great nation of ours. And so, you know, if we're students today, they need to know about these people who are really rather obscure because they haven't been taught about them. But just to know that we all have contributed to the greatness of this country of ours. And it's just so important, I think. And so I hope that our book in some small way can, you know, let a child know or let anyone know, even adults, well, wow, we didn't know this. And this is good to know about the many of the people who are in the book who had to overcome so much. But mainly that we've all contributed to our country and its greatness.
So what's next for the rights?
Well, I tell you, there's a project I can't announce right now. In fact, we're working on it now. It's one of the city officials has asked about doing. And so it's all on the exploratory stage to see if we can pull it off. And then, you know, since we did this 100, over 100, start gathering information for another 100, because we have so many who have been left behind. And probably when we finish that, there'll be another group of people. In the process of doing research, you find a lot of things, and people will call you and tell you about things. And so it's a never-ending process. You never finish. There's room for 100 other books by other individuals.
Well, he's interested our sons, two of our sons in this too, Susan. So, you know, we'll see what they come up with. They're both teachers, too.
The next generation of rights writers.
That's right.
Well, John and Sylvia Wright, I really appreciate you being on Casey Currents.
Well, thank you so much for having us, Susan.
John and Sylvia Wright are co-authors of a new book called Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who've Made History.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. A new kind of food hub is popping up across the country. These food processing and distribution centers make it easier for restaurants, grocery stores, and others to buy local food. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says there are more than 220 of them in 40 states, plus the District of Columbia. As Sean Powers reports for Harvest Public Media, it's a trend that's not only helping struggling farms, but also bringing in new talent to agriculture.
Max! Pick, pick, pick. Come on, Max.
Donna O'Shaughnessy and her husband are first-generation farmers in rural Chatsworth, Illinois, about 2 hours south of Chicago. They sell dairy and meat. O'Shaughnessy was a full-time nurse for many years while her husband focused on the farm. They ended each year in the red, but about 5 years ago, business took off, with restaurant owners as far away as Chicago putting in order requests.
For years, we did not think we could ever be totally sustainable, that we would always need my nursing income. But then when things really started to pick up with us, we made that decision I would retire from nursing. And ironically, that's when we started to turn a profit because I was able to do the marketing.
And her husband focused on other tasks on the farm. This was all possible because they joined a year-round food hub called Stewards of the Land, started in 2005 by this guy.
Peppermint, borage flowers,
radish pods.
That should be it.
It's a little after 6 o'clock on a recent morning in the nearby town of Fairbury. Marty Travis and his son Will load a van with roughly 1,500 pounds of food from about a dozen area farmers, who filled a walk-in cooler the night before with fruits and vegetables, poultry and meat, and grains and flour. In about an hour, Travis drives the shipment to restaurants and grocery stores throughout central Illinois and Chicago. Basically, he's the middleman. A farmer himself, he took on this role to fill a hole in the market.
So as we go, we can incubate these farms and get them on their feet to do their own things.
Travis and his wife founded this food hub and started a second one a few years later. Members include about 40 small family farmers who pay a small fee to join. Travis says they get cheaper liability insurance, access to a much larger pool of businesses, and farmer training.
I would say the new generation farmers are a little over half of the group. Many of them were under the age of 18 when they joined. We're very interested in growing great produce, but we're also very, very passionate about growing farmers.
One up-and-coming farmer is 15-year-old Derek Stoller of Fairbury. He joined Stewards of the Land when he was 9 years old and growing Indian corn. Since then, working in his parents' backyard and putting his family to work, he's moved on to other things like beets, parsley, and carrots.
Last year I grossed around 15,000.
What's probably the most exciting thing you've learned about this sort of work?
That you can grow off of a little patch of land and make a lot of money off of it.
We recognize that there is significant opportunity for small entrepreneurs.
That's Doug O'Brien, the USDA's acting undersecretary of rural development.
For those who are willing maybe to pay a little bit more for food that comes from close by, that infrastructure is lacking, but it's growing fast. Food hubs respond to that call.
The USDA recently awarded a nearly $100,000 grant to set up 3 food hubs in central Illinois. One of the people behind that effort is Tara Brockman. She estimates the region loses about $5 billion annually because money is spent on food and agricultural inputs from outside the area.
It used to be that when we talked about rural development, we talked about prisons and factories. And, you know, we're finally at the point where it's like, hey, look around in Illinois. When you're talking rural, you're talking farming, particularly this kind of small farming, direct marketed, feed your community kind of farming, where the money does stay and circulate within your community.
O'Brien expects the USDA to continue supporting food hubs, though some farmers worry that could lead to more regulations, even with federal support. But at least for now, that doesn't appear to be keeping food hubs from growing. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sean Powers in Urbana, Illinois.
After the break, we kick off our Creative Couple series with artists Mark Sutherland and Peregrine Honig. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. The work of iconic Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera is on display this summer at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. They're part of an exhibit called Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and the Masterpieces of Modern Mexico. Kahlo and Rivera are known not only for their paintings, but for their tempestuous marriage, which sometimes inspired their art. inspired by Kahlo and Rivera, over the next month on KC Currents, we're going to profile a few of Kansas City's creative couples. We want to find out how two artists make a life together and how their relationship influences their work. Sylvia has this profile of our first couple, who totally reject the idea that a relationship between artists should be full of conflict.
Ask artist Peregrine Honig if unhappiness in a relationship will lead to great art. Her answer, hell no. Her husband, Mark Sutherland, brings up something that was part of their marriage vows.
What's the famous Flaubert quote?
Here it is.
Peregrine brings it up on her cell phone.
Be regular and orderly in your life so that you may be violent and original in your work.
For Peregrine and Mark, that regular and orderly domestic life is the foundation they need to explore some dramatic ideas in their art. And part of creating that order has been developing some routines. They often begin their days at a coffee shop. This time it's Lil Freshy on the west side, just a few blocks from their apartment.
We usually can have this moment together where we sort of collect
our thoughts
for the day and just find out what each other are up to today.
And what the other one is supposed to do.
Right. And what the other one is supposed to do to help the other one today.
And with them, as always, is Tiny Beignet, a silky black-haired Papillon Chihuahua mix.
Oh, Beignet.
Peregrine and Mark are at the center of Kansas City's art scene, bringing people together for happenings like Mardi Gras and the 18th Street Fashion Show. That's 18th Street and the Crossroads, where Peregrine's lingerie shop, Birdie's, is. She's also a painter, illustrator, and printmaker. She made a name for herself nationally with her delicate and disturbing watercolors of prepubescent girls. Mark plays experimental jazz. He makes playful horn sculptures and most recently has created fantastic environments for his performances, which involve costumes, dance, sculptural installations, food, and even live animals. Here he's playing saxophone with one of his groups, Snuff Jazz, on a recent gig at Grunauer in the Crossroads. Peregrine's from San Francisco, but moved to KC to attend the Art Institute. It was soon after she graduated that she began hanging out in the same circle of musicians and artists as Mark. She started making album covers and posters for him.
She was just really sort of beautiful and intriguing in a way that set her apart in my mind. And we always had a strange sort of respect for each other, I thought, in the midst of whatever was going on around us. There was like we were taking some kind of care for whatever future we had.
But nothing happened between them until Mark invited Peregrine on a road trip to Chicago in his 79 Cadillac.
And just a pile of 8-tracks in the back, and I just totally fell in love with him on the way there. I called my friend, I was like, this is the man I'm going to marry. This is it. I knew it. He rolls his eyes, but it was amazing.
That was 13 years ago. They married in 2006. And now?
Our art world, whatever it is nearly fully integrated into our domestic life, our husband and wife-ery.
That's what you see when you walk into their ground floor loft apartment. The living room used to be Peregrine's exhibition space. It's now Mark's studio. His leather sculptures are drying on a work table. A giant mutant horn hangs from the ceiling, and shiny yellow honeycomb hexagons are stuck on one wall. And then there's the 30-foot couch.
Entire bands have slept just on this couch, yeah. Like head to toe.
For Peregrine, living in the midst of making art comes naturally. For Mark, the chaos has taken a little getting used to. You might not think it from listening to his music, but he's the orderly, pragmatic one. He takes care of a lot of their errands and scheduling. She helps him think about big conceptual projects.
Peregrine sort of lives in a conceptual realm, which is why sometimes she's not always really great at, like, so what, you know, what time is this at? And she'll be like, I don't know, what day is it? You know, so, but then when you ask her, well, what do you think about, you know, this piece of art and how it relates to this? She just naturally is thinking that way. It's beautiful and fascinating and only occasionally annoying.
But Mark admits she's helped him talk about his art. He used to undermine it, calling it wacky jazz, and couldn't explain to other musicians why he wore costumes while he performed. He came to a turning point in his work when, 5 years ago, they hosted an installation in their loft by the artists Carolyn Hopkins and Stuart Lossie.
All of the elements of the interior had turned into these leaping deer and rabbits and squirrels. And then Stuart basically made a huge outdoor backdrop. So, and I can only say maybe some kind of, hyperdimensional sun object that was on a timer, so it would just get blindingly bright.
And I loved waking up in our little lofted bedroom, stepping out and seeing this, just this beautiful and sort of fantastic installation.
I mean,
oh yeah, it was
really
great. I think every time I stepped into it, and I would come down and turn on the super sun and brush my teeth under the super sun.
Mark got permission to perform inside the installation, and he says it was an important moment for him.
I was already doing like Wee Snuff, where I was performing in crazy costumes on tiny instruments and doing these different things, but all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I can not only change this little world, I can transform even bigger worlds around me. I can even do more things to impact the music and visuals of what I'm doing. Let's change everything about everything.
Mark now makes these musical tableaus, collaborating with many performers, musicians, and artists, including Peregrine, of course. He's currently working on a piece called No More Nomads, about the end of nomadic cultures around the world. We're hearing some of the music for that now. Peregrine's recently stepped up some of her more money-making ventures so that Mark could quit his job cleaning and repairing instruments to focus on this project full-time. It's part of the give and take of their relationship.
Your relationship with your art is almost, it can almost feel like it's a separate coupling that you have with your creative self. So when you get to spend more time with your creative self than I get to spend with my creative self, it can get jealous.
With all their collaborative work, there are aspects to each other's creativity that Mark and Peregrine keep separate. She's not schooled in music, and he says he can't begin to understand how she turns the chaos of her process into clean and delicate art.
And it's still sort of a mystery to me, and I always sort of want it to be.
Instead of finding inspiration in conflict, like Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, Mark Sutherland and Peregrine Honig say they need consistency and comfort in their relationship, so they have the strength to tackle the chaos and explosiveness of their ideas.
We'll be airing stories about some of Kansas City's creative couples for the next 5 weeks. Find photographs of the couples in their element, as well as some special online-only stories, on our website at kcur.org. Bring together Bob Dylan, AC/DC, and the traditions from the Lakota Nation, a Native American tribe now found in South Dakota, and what do you get? These were the influences that inspired local musician Mo Brings Plenty to get into music. He's originally from South Dakota and toured with the contemporary Native American music group Bruley for 5 years before settling down in Kansas City in 2011. Shortly after his arrival, Mo Brings Plenty teamed up with another local musician to create the Brings Plenty Band.
Today, they're four musicians who combine contemporary Native music, dance, and storytelling, the oral tradition Native Americans use to pass down stories and history between the generations.
I want to bring awareness that we as Indigenous people are still here.
The Brings Plenty Band has performed around the country and will be playing at the Kansas City Fringe Festival next weekend. From their album Prairie Moon, we end today's show with the song Horse Nation.
Way off, 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 way off Kile wakacha che wakielo namahuelo hai.
We're listening to the song Horse Nation from the Brings Plenty Band. They'll be performing next week at Union Station as part of the KC Fringe Festival.
Well, once again, we appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith and special help from Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Ryan Schisler and Monica Sandretsky. Our theme music is by Approach, and as always, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.